Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In moments, we'll hear from the political ecologist Jason Moore on the mischievous notion that humans are somehow apart from nature. And then at the bottom of the hour, Jennifer Doyle investigates the explosive mix of security, paranoia, and sex on American college campuses. First, Jason Moore. In his new book, Capitalism and the Web of Life, from Verso, Moore investigates how capitalism produces nature as a category separate from the human and how this perspective explains and enables how we therefore treat the earth as a disposable. He is an assistant professor of sociology at Binghamton University. You can find many of his writings on his personal website, jasonwmoore.com. Jason Moore. I guess we're all Cartesians, knowing it or not, right?
All a little bit Cartesian, but all a little bit dialectical.
Well, let's talk about the Cartesian model, the mind-body split, the human nature split. That dominates very conventional thinking, whether we know it or not, and also a lot of radical ecological thinking as well. So lay out that model.
Okay, so the basic idea of environmental studies up until the present, from about the 1970s to the present, has been let's take capitalism or society or humanity and put it in one box. And then let's look at the environmental conditions or consequences, and we'll put that in another box. So you put nature in one box and humanity in another box. That's what I call green arithmetic. So we say capitalism plus nature, or if you are in the Anthropocene discussion, humanity plus nature, or race plus nature, class, gender plus nature. So it's an additive perspective, and it's been very useful up to this point of putting nature into one box and humanity into another box. What I'm saying now is that the messiness of the crises and the challenges that the world faces today demands a different way of seeing how this world came to be. And that would be a relational, or what I'm calling a world ecological perspective.
When did this conceptual split between human and nature, or society and nature, originate?
That's a great question. And a lot of people take it as just common sense. And like any great distinction or binary, the split between humanity on the one hand and nature on the other occurred and developed over a long period of time. But if we look at the rise of European-centered capitalism in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, you think of the Age of Conquest, the conquest of the Americas, the Age of Scientific Revolution, the rise of the slave trade, all of these profound earth-shaking and human-shaking transformations, the idea that some parts of the world would be called nature and others parts would be called society, or what Adam Smith called civilized society, began to take root. And it wasn't just an idea floating out there in the ether. In fact, what happened over these centuries after 1450 was that some humans became were accorded the right to be called humans. They were given human rights. All of what we would call nature was treated as an object to be plundered, transformed, basically sacked for riches and turned into a productive resource.
And natives were sometimes considered part of nature.
That's right? Exactly. This is the part. Women, indigenous peoples, African slaves in this period were all considered part of nature. Maybe a few European women were considered part of civilized society, but for the most part, the idea of a human nature split is rooted in a set of very violent, bloody economic and imperial processes that say, okay, African slaves, you get to be part of nature. Women, you get to be part of nature. Indigenous peoples, definitely part of nature. In fact, the Spaniards had a special word for indigenous peoples in colonial Peru in the 17th century. They called them naturales.
And some thinkers even took that to the human person. Emerson considered the body as part of the not me. So the body is almost part of nature.
That's right. And there's been a long, I think, dialogue over what is that relation between human thought and the distinctiveness that humans do have to make symbols, to create collective memory. to do a lot of things with language and symbols that other species cannot, and that's hugely significant. And what I'm saying is that the significance of what is distinctively human is heightened once we see that humans are a part of nature, rather than treating them as separate. And we know from all sorts of research for and philosophy for centuries that humans are deeply embedded in the web of life.
But our discomfort with our own human nature sometimes results in all kinds of extravagant repressions and bizarre alienations.
Well, that's right. And capitalism, of course, is premised on a whole series of alienations that we then internalize, starting with the very bloody and violent processes of primitive accumulation, of divorcing peasants from immediate customary access to the means of production. So everybody has to compete on the market in one way or another to obtain cash to make a living. And that's an alienation that is all about this nature-society split. So when radicals are using this nature-society split and this language of nature and society, they are in fact using a language of capitalism coming into the world with blood and dirt. They are using a language of imperialism. Now, at the same time, of course, we all are wrestling with this alienation. And so, of course, we're going to have a messy vocabulary as we extract ourselves from this language, because it's not just about words.
And of course, the split you're talking about is really coeval with and foundational to the development of capitalism.
That's absolutely right. That the whole capitalist way of seeing the world, Donna Haraway calls it the God trick, that you can step out of the world and you can pretend that you are gazing upon this external globe, this external nature that you can then go out and turn into a set of productive objects. That is at the absolute center of capitalism. I think one of the things that's happened with a lot of radical greens, especially in academia, is that there is a sense that capitalism is simply a material process. And lo and behold, as Marx tells us, ideas themselves can become a material force. And I think that's what we're seeing with nature society.
Now, how does this relate to John Bellamy Foster's concept of the metabolic rift?
Okay, so in the idea of the metabolic rift, there are different arguments floating about. So John Bellamy Foster is certainly one of the great ecological Marxists of the past 20 years and has really pioneered a way of thinking. He calls this the metabolic rift. And there are different versions of this argument. At its crudest, the rift argument says there is a rift or a separation between humanity and nature. So Bellamy Foster, in his own political economy, has been very clear that there is no necessary relation between environmental change and economic crisis. And that seems to me to be a fairly extreme position, because more or less everything that capitalists are doing, even internet capitalists, they are using parts of nature to transform it into wealth, into money, into profit. So there's a strange way of thinking on that has taken root around this concept of the metabolic rift. And I say, what we need to do is to move from metabolic rift, which presumes that capitalism and nature are separate, to move to metabolic shift. There is in fact one metabolism, as Marx argued, and not that everything that Marx said was right, but in this case it's very
useful.
An awful lot was. And for Marx, Marx says there's one metabolism and there are contradictions within it. So there are metabolisms of work and of power and of capital flows in the world. So we start asking in this perspective, not metabolic shift, but not metabolic rift, but metabolic shift. That is, how do these flows get reworked in the interest of maximizing profit?
Some of this sounds a bit like myths of the fall. We were once in Eden and unalienated, and then suddenly we got alienated and separated from nature.
Right.
And there's a kind of neo-primitivism in some environmental thinking that just wants us to go back to the garden, you know, Joni Mitchell's soundtrack. How does what you're saying differ from that?
You're being very gracious, I think. For almost all of the green left and academic left, and there are some important exceptions. I mentioned Donna Haraway, and there are many others. But there is this idea of a pristine nature of what once was. And it's exactly that, the tales of the fall. I think that that's problematic for a lot of reasons. Now, first of all, as everyone realizes, humans have been changing the planet for a long time.
And since we first arrived.
Exactly, as all species do. And the other thing is that this idea of a pristine nature, this idea of tales from the fall, leads a very subtle and quiet existence by shaping the words that we use to tell stories about how capitalism makes environments. And so the language is often one of disruption or of an external force coming in and upsetting the balance of nature. And that kind of way of narrating the story of how we got to be here in the 21st century that says, okay, capitalism comes in and disrupts nature as an external actor, that feeds very easily into Neo-Malthusian myths of resource scarcity, of the biosphere or of nature as this absolute external limit to capital, and it won't be capitalism's internal contradictions, it won't be class conflict, it won't be economic crisis, it won't be political crisis, it will be the catastrophe.
I'm always reminded of a quote from Adorno who said, the image of undistorted nature arises only in distortion as its opposite.
Well, that's profound. I'm not sure what to make of that, but perhaps what you're hinting at is that the nature-society binary is the unity of the web of life, including humans, turned inside out.
Okay, so I should say I'm speaking with Jason Moore, who's the author of Capitalism and the Web of Life from Verso. Let's talk about your critique of these kinds of dualisms. You don't buy it.
There's a way of telling the story of how we as a species and we as inhabitants of a capitalist world have arrived at this absolutely disastrous state of affairs. That state of affairs, of course, has to do with climate change and mass extinction, but it also has to do with austerity, with financial instability, with a long-run stagnation of the productive capacity of capitalism. Labor productivity has been experiencing stagnant growth for decades now in the North. There are a set of very powerful indicators that we see in the world around us that a dualist way of looking at things will not help us draw the intimate connections between them. So if we see climate change and extinction in one box, and financial instability and the employment crisis and the crisis of megacities in the global south as a separate crisis, then we are never going to get to a politics that can put the two together. We're never going to get to a politics because we will never get to the kinds of stories and the kinds of analytics of explanations that show the really intimate connections between these processes. And that's why I'm saying, let's stop looking at it as nature plus society or capitalism plus nature. Let's start looking at it as capitalism in nature or financialization in nature.
And I think a conventional way of thinking about capitalism, whether people use this vocabulary or not, is, you know, it's all about producing commodities, about producing goods and services, but we also produce nature through capitalism.
Well, that's right. And as Marx recognized, the production of commodities is the production of nature. The thing about capitalism that I would highlight and that I try to unpack in the book is that people think about capitalism, like you said, as a market system, as a commodity system, and then everything outside of that commodity system is outside of capitalism.
What I say sort of arrives on the doorstep,
yeah,
somehow.
Exactly. It's just, you know, and parts of nature and parts of humanity get sucked into the capitalist vortex over time. Well, there's truth to that. However, what I'm saying is that capitalism has always been a story, a history of islands of commodity production and exchange within oceans of what I call the unpaid work of nature, including human nature, especially, of course, women's work. That capitalism has been built on the work of soils, of forests, but of course also of humans who have been, like I said earlier, absolutely treated as part of nature with a capital N, not paid, deeply oppressed, deeply disrespected. And so there's a tension at the core of how I think we should start seeing capitalism, to see it as islands of commodification within oceans of unpaid work, the unpaid work of nature. What's happening today is that the capacity to extend and expand into these new frontiers of unpaid work is becoming increasingly limited, not least through global warming.
Now, there's an analogy here to the feminist critique of Marxism that arose in the 70s, which criticized Marxism for failing to account, or actually mainstream economics as well, for failing to account for the unpaid labor of women. So you're drawing an analogy also with the unpaid work of nature.
That's absolutely right. And what this book was inspired by the feminist Marxist debates of the 1970s, of Federici and Lise Vogel and Dalla Costa and all these groundbreaking scholars. Where did they end up? It was, well, there's a system of the oppression of women and a system of the capitalism, patriarchy and capitalism. What I've been trying to do is to say that capitalism works through the appropriation of the unpaid work of women, but also the unpaid work of extra human natures, and that in capital's eyes, and I know that sounds perverse, that in capital's eyes, when it takes the unpaid work of nature and women, it sees them all as nature with a capital N. So it's again this divide of humanity and nature in terms of how capitalism functions. Capitalism only sees humans who have cash in their pockets.
Oh, or labor.
Or labor.
Or the
potential to labor for cash in their pockets. That's exactly right.
Yes, and a lot of that work of women is framed as the work of nature because it's about food, it's about children. The bodily functions and the brawny, brainy stuff is for men.
That's exactly right. So it gives rise to a whole series of oppressive differentiations. For me, part of why I wrote this book, and I hope that it comes through, is to advance a conversation where instead of talking about gender plus environment or race or class plus environment, we are seeing that the questions of class, race, and gender are fundamentally products of a system that turns some parts of nature into productive resources, treats them as nature, and many of those parts are humans who are women or people of color, and then reserves this much smaller sphere of humanity that it's going to call society. When we ask these questions today of, well, whose lives matter, much of that discourse turns on who is part of nature and who is part of society.
And you write about the four cheaps, which has been something that capitalism has depended upon, a quartet that capitalism has depended upon for centuries. What are the four cheaps?
So the four cheaps are labor, food, energy, and raw materials. And the argument is very simple, that capitalism is a system of cheap nature, that it is continually seeking to find new ways to turn nature into productive work as cheaply as possible, and that every great long wave of economic growth, of capital accumulation, has been premised on great upheavals in the world, new discoveries of, say, coal and putting coal seams to work or oil fields, but also of drawing vast peasant societies into a world wage labor market. So again, what we're trying to do is to draw the interconnections between how all these processes work, that the question of labor and the question of nature have to be understood as entwined with each other in the most intimate ways. Otherwise, we end up with a green politics that's what? Neo-Malthusian.
But now you're arguing, among other things, that the four cheaps are no longer so cheap, and they're not going to remain cheap.
It's starting to look that way, with the exception, and you know what I'm going to say, with the exception of, yes, solarization maybe is possible. So maybe we could see a solar revolution, but again, I would be indebted to your argument about the financialization of the American bourgeoisie and its fragmented and limited historical vision. Is it interested in pursuing that kind of transition?
I just saw a Bloomberg story, I believe yesterday or today, with the headline, you know, we're at the beginning of an energy revolution. So at least some capitalists are very enthused about this.
Maybe. The question is, and I know this is something that you and Christian Parenti have talked about, is the state going to get into that project in a major way? Maybe. But even so, you have other massive problems that are going on in terms of cheap energy over the short run. So production costs continue to rise. Even though, yes, energy prices are down, the Financial Times says, well, cheap energy, that's the new cheap labor. So you have a limited reconcentration of manufacturing in the U.S. because of that, which I think validates my argument. But of course, also we have these historically low interest rates that are making possible a strange kind of temporary substitution effect for some of what cheap nature did in decades and centuries past.
But of course, then climate change is going to make everything more expensive.
That's the big problem for capital. And I think what economic theory, certainly neoclassical, but even Marxist theory hasn't really come to grips with, is that all these great waves of economic expansion where some great new epic-making invention, like the steam engine and railroads, or like the automobile complex, those innovations and vast complexes that sucked up surplus capital on a massive scale, they all depended to one degree or another on the restoration of cheap nature. Steam engine comes from coal. It's like finding $2 billion in your backyard. Or the oil complex was, of course, based on the oil automobile complex was, of course, based on cheap oil, but also cheap steel, cheap rubber. So what does every industrial capitalist want besides cheap labor? Of course, cheap raw materials. And cheap raw materials cost also impacts the cheapness or dearness of fixed capital, of machinery.
I always wonder when I hear arguments like yours when I was reading your book, do you underestimate the innovative power of capitalism?
No, and I'll give you a very specific answer why. The innovative power of capitalism has always rested on being able to go out to a frontier, maybe a labor frontier, maybe a resource frontier, and to suck up cheap nature and to build vast dynamic production complexes on the basis of cheap nature. Sugar plantations or silver mines in the early modern centuries, or the great textile mills of Manchester. Cheap coal and cheap cotton from cheap labor, slaves working on the Mississippi Delta. So yeah, that's a stylized argument. There's something to that. There's something to that that I don't think that economic theorists across the ideological spectrum have adequately come to grips with. And for reasons that escape me, I don't think the ecological economists have done it either. And my provisional answer is because we are still trapped in this binary of nature plus society, of labor plus nature. And in fact, we need, I believe, in order to answer this question, you know, have I underestimated capitalism's innovative power? Maybe, but we need to ask the right questions to get to that answer.
I believe Rhett Butler, of all people, said something about it's quicker, you can make a lot more money on the collapse of a society than you can make in building up one.
Some people can make more money. And that's the rub, too, that many, many people on the green left say, well, capitalists will continue to make a profit even as the whole edifice crumbles. Some capitalists will, but the great expansions and of capitalism premised on these great innovations like the steam engine or the combustion engine or the shipbuilding and map making revolution of the early modern centuries, those innovations benefited a huge critical mass of the world bourgeoisie. And that has to be factored into the present analysis. Yes, of course, some capitalists are going to make a killing on the collapse of whatever we're going to call this, capitalist civilization.
So let's return to your point about the web of life and your anti-dualism. What, if anything, does that mean for practical ecological politics?
I think it means working to unify this domain of what I'm calling socio-ecological reproduction, which is a bit of a mouthful. And I think we're going to find a better vocabulary for a lot of these relational politics and the relations of humans with the rest of nature. How do we unify socio-ecological reproduction, not just social reproduction, healthcare, education, the family, but also the reproduction of life on the biosphere, the carbon cycle? How do we take that and unify it with struggles and movements in production? And then how do we unify those in turn with struggles that are oriented, say, against austerity or for employment within particular social formations? So we have kind of national politics has to be in there as well, and international politics, of course. So how do you build those alliances that transcend the old jobs versus environment dualism? And how do we figure out a political strategy?
How do we?
Well, I think
I was thinking back in the Republican debate from the other night and comparing it with the way you're talking right now, and it leads me to despair.
The Republican debate gave us many reasons to despair. I'm somewhat hardened without having illusions at the Bernie Sanders movement, because I think it does pose political questions at the level of the national state. And I think that it poses issues that can only be resolved at the level of the national state. And here I would say I despair often at a kind of left academic social movement posturing that pretends that disparate local struggles will somehow spontaneously create the society that we want. And so
there's a notion of secession or creating autonomous zones.
There is, and the transition towns movement and that old back to the earth, you know, separate out from the rest of society vision from the 70s, I think, was always a dead end.
And any kind of political transformation of the kind you're evoking would require scale, right?
It absolutely requires scale. And that's the difficult thing, because, of course, all politics is local. We know that. But also today, in an era of mass extinction and global climate change, all politics has to be biospheric. And this dualism of nature and society is often reinforced by another dualism that we're talking about right now, the dualism of the local and the national, or the local and the global. So once we get on one dualism, we end up on a whole series of other dualisms, in my view. And how do we thread those needles? Well, we need to have serious politics that challenge austerity and that present an alternative model. And what is this? Today we have the golden age of left reformism. Who knows if it will go anywhere with Sanders and Corbyn, and who knows, maybe in Portugal. Without being optimistic, I mean, I'm not terribly optimistic about social democrats, but I think that it says something about the zeitgeist that the severity of the crisis in this world is beginning to register, even on segments of political classes.
That was Jason Moore, assistant professor of sociology at Binghamton University and author of Capitalism and the Web of Life, Ecology and the Accumulation of Capital, published a few months ago by Verso. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Nature and Me by the Volcano Sons, mined from the 1980s post-punk bin. Next, Jennifer Doyle. Doyle is a writer, art historian, and queer theorist who teaches at the University of California, Riverside. She also writes about sports. Her book, Campus Sex, Campus Security, published by Semiotext, explores the volatile mix of rape, fear, and repression on university campuses today, mainly larger public universities in this age of austerity. To quote the publisher's description, "What is the university campus in this world? Who is it for? What sort of psychic space does it simultaneously produce and police? What is it that we want, really, when we call campus security?" Jennifer Doyle. You open your book by talking about the famous pepper spray incident at UC Davis. You present a picture of the campus these days as being a paranoid, insecure, frightening place. It's been a long time since I spent time in a university campus in any meaningful way, and it certainly seems to have changed. But what is the UC Davis pepper spray story? Tell us about the situation of the campus at a large public university now.
Well, so this incident dates back to the Occupy movement. So in this case, students were protesting rising tuition and expressing solidarity with the Occupy movement. And the demonstrations across the UC campuses had been pretty uniformly peaceful, very communitarian. But at Davis, which is close to both Berkeley and Oakland, the administration was very anxious about the confrontations that were, you know, characterizing the interactions between demonstrators and police at UC Berkeley, and then also the way in which the Occupy camp in Oakland was being policed. Administrators were really anxious to quash the demonstrations at UC Davis. So there was a deployment of University of California police officers to break up a student camp, and the students, you know, were rightfully asking, like, why their demonstration was being broken up, what rules they were breaking. There was no real answer to this. They sat down in a demonstration of passive resistance, and the officers, namely one in particular, who became known as, like, Pepper Spray Cop, took out a can of pepper spray and saturated students who were just sitting down on the ground. This got captured by video and photographs, and it went viral and became kind of a pepper spray cop meme. the University of California Office of the President, which governs the statewide system, commissioned an independent investigation from Kroll Securities. That's publicly available. So when you read that document, one of the things that really leapt out at me was the use of Title IX as a rationalizing discourse for the deployment of police. So the chancellor and other administrators had expressed their concern that if the demonstrators slept in tents overnight in an Occupy-style camp, that there might be a sexual assault. And they were worried about the presence of outsiders, older men from Oakland. This is all language lifted right out of the report. And what might happen if these outsiders, meaning older men whose records we don't know, basically had sexual intimacy with the quote-unquote very young girls who go to UC Davis. And over and over again in the report, that was cited as the reason for using the UC police to break up the camp. You know, speaking as a literary critic, you know, it's a paranoid fantasy. You know, this paranoid fantasy that the space of the campus is being penetrated by older men from outside the university. You know, and so they kind of conjure this risk, right, as a rationalization for securitizing the campus, which is really just the same thing as suppressing dissent. But what's clear in the report is that the administration itself was really kind of in the grip of this paranoid fantasy. You know, this is a real and true anxiety for them. It's kind of like a schizophrenic projection, in a sense.
Well, you know, you say paranoid fantasy, and this reminds me of a friend of mine who was in a clinical psychology internship at a VA hospital during the Central American Wars of the 1980s. And he had a psychotic patient who was worried that the communists were going to crawl up through Texas. And it made this, in his mind, Texas was like crawling up his anus.
Yeah.
Which is, say something about Texas, perhaps. This was the fantasy of a frankly psychotic man, that that kind of political risk was so bodily. And here we have a university administration showing symptoms that are very, very similar. What is behind this?
That question is a challenging one. Like, where does this come from? And in my book, I'm not really able to provide strict answers for this. I do think this is part of the kind of an emergence of a security state model, right, as a dominant model for thinking about like what the state is and what the responsible governance looks like, you know. And so there I'm sort of thinking about a more recent scholarship from people like, for example, Chesbir Poir, who's a conversation partner for me as a scholar, like kind of the movement out of something like a neoliberal state into something else, right? So I think one of the things that we're seeing is like a first world version of security state logics, which actually come from and emerge out of like other zones, right? So places like Johannesburg or...
But this discourse is also deeply sexualized.
Yes, absolutely, right. And that's also true for this security state, these security state formations. Internationally, when you look around, you see, you know, the idea of, say, for example, protecting women's rights being used to rationalize certain levels of involvement. These are really sort of complex issues in terms of thinking about like global politics. But I'm sort of looking at those zones and thinking, you know, it's kind of funny how you see that kind of strange intermingling of sexual anxieties and then fear just around the idea of sex, right? It's not just sexual assault, but it's also sexual possibility emerging in the middle of a conflict that is all about, say, for example, opening up the university to more people when students are demanding, they're calling for tuition reduction and the elimination of a student debt, that this is about opening up the campus to more and more people.
Then dark guys are going to come from Oakland and rape our young girls, right?
Or go to school. That fear about who's coming from outside and penetrating the campus, right, gets configured as a rape in terms of a narrative about securitizing like the vulnerable female body. The aim of a public university ought to be able to open up the university to more and more people, right?
Now, the students, though, in the face of this threat from the cop, one of the things they said was, go ahead, shoot your children. They became children and not, you know, demonstrators who are more or less adults.
Yes. Now, in the video record of that incident, you can hear that the students are chanting to the police and they're, you know, playing with the chanting. And there's a moment when the police take out these things that they look like machine guns. They're pepper ball launchers. They were pointing them actually at the students, which you're actually not supposed to do. That's when the students started to shout. It's like, don't shoot the students. And then it shifted to don't shoot the children or don't shoot your children. I think this is partly a way in which you know, student demonstrators in general, you know, are looking for ways to make visible the passive side of their forms of resistance, right? Because the police use their fear of threat to rationalize their use of violence. And so students try to theatricalize and make very, and you know, it's a reasonable strategy to make as visible as possible that they are not threatening. And so in this sense, one invokes like the child, but then there's also that kind of weaves itself into the principle of in loco parentis, right? The university's institutional relationship to students as children to whom they have a responsibility, even though, you know, the overwhelming majority of college students are legally adults, right? The university itself adopts a parental relationship to them, which students, for the most part, actually collaborate with. And it's not just students, too. I would say that faculty as well, that we tend to look to the institution, the university, as one that has our interests at heart, our best interests at heart. And we believe in the university, right, as this system, the heart and soul of which, right, is, you know, in essence, making things better for more people. and then in these sites of conflict where these investments are betrayed.
You mentioned Title IX a few minutes ago, and I imagine a lot of people in the audience won't know what that is. So how does Title IX figure into this?
Title IX is a really interesting sort of, it's a huge area, right, it's an amendment to the Higher Education Act that was passed in 1972 that barred sex discrimination in education. And so any educational organization receiving federal funds is impacted by Title IX legislation. So you have an obligation to prevent discrimination on the basis of sex, gender, sexuality. And over the years, as Title IX legislation has articulated itself largely in the forms of students asserting this right to be free from sex discrimination, this area has actually covered the zone of sexual assault on college campuses, in the sense that this is a gendered form of violence, right, or gendered form of harassment. And as a gendered form of harassment, it impacts people as gendered subjects, right, and their access to education. So if you're sexually assaulted by a student, as a student, and the university doesn't have any means for addressing the harm that's done by that assault, then this has a disproportionate impact, right, on people who are vulnerable to sexual assault, which is overwhelmingly women, right? So this is a really interesting situation for universities because it takes sort of individual acts of harm and it places them within the context of systemic discrimination. You can say that students who are right now standing up, taking a stand against racist forms of harassment on university campuses are making a very similar kind of intervention, that these individual acts, harmful acts of harassment and discrimination are part of a larger, you know, kind of systemic problem. The Title IX gives a very kind of specific way of articulating this and articulating it around sexual assault. It has become, over time, one of the sites of the greatest forms of financial exposure for universities, right, insofar as when their systems let down victims of sexual assault or victims of gendered forms of harassment and discrimination on colleges, this has resulted in very large settlements or very large decisions, in the millions of dollars. You know, and so universities have had a very strong incentive to kind of get ahead of that. But then the ways in which they get ahead of that, right, has been rather than confront systemic sexual discrimination, right, is to narrow that into thinking about sexual assault. This is my view, right? And so that individual cases of sexual assault get rendered in a language of a conflict between the abuser and the abused, and that gets disarticulated from the way in which such an event fits within a very big system of gender discrimination, right? And also, like, within the university, there's an enormous amount of discomfort, aporia, right, around the importance of sexual culture to a university campus, right? That this is where, as a queer studies scholar, I got very interested in this issue, that fighting discrimination becomes mobilized within a security apparatus, right, which is actually very deeply conservative.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Doyle, who's a professor of English at the University of California, Riverside, and is author of Campus Sex, Campus Security, from Semiotext. Yeah, several times in the book you write that this discourse around rape on campuses constructs women as always vulnerable and men as always awful. Well, talk some more about that. What does this mean for the relations of human beings who live on these campuses?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes to things that are generally true, right? I mean, I wrote this book in part because I felt frustrated by the character of feminist writing in and kind of commentary around this subject, you know, where you're sort of either on the side of rape victims, you know, or you're at risk of minimizing the problem, you know, so that when people have stepped forward to try to complicate the narrative, they end up being characterized as like a rape denier. You know, it's a really polarized public discourse right now, especially regarding sexual assault. So one thing that I want to make clear is that one of the problems that we grapple with when we're thinking about or trying to navigate experiences of assault, abuse, and harassment as gendered subjects is that, for example, like most people who are sexually assaulted in the United States are women, right? That's the biggest risk factor for sexual assault, right? Is not whether or not you're in college, it's what gender you are. And related to that will be the way in which you may present gender. Like if you're gender non-conforming, trans women, for example, are at a much higher risk of gendered forms of violence, right, than, say, cisgendered men. Most people who are sexually assaulted, if I understand the studies correctly, are sexually assaulted before the age of 30, so between adolescence and 30, right, which happens to be also when people are in college. So one of the reasons why statistics regarding the frequency of sexual assaults are so high for college students is because during that age period, that's when a woman in particular in the United States is most vulnerable to being sexually assaulted, right? So age is a very strong indicator of your risk factor, right? And college actually enters into the picture because it actually shapes, again, this is as far as I can tell from different studies, and there's conflicting kind of data on this. But in general, it does seem as though college impacts the way in which you're going to be sexually assaulted. So, right, if you're not in college, you may be more likely to be assaulted by someone that you're in a relationship with or by a family member, right? Be quite explicit form of intimate partner violence if you're not in college, right? But if you are in college, it may be more connected to the social spaces of a college, right? In terms of the ways in which underage students, meaning underage in relationship to drinking, socialize with each other and within the specific kind of culture of the campus. I'm trying to kind of enter into this picture to think about like why in the United States we've accepted in general in public discourse about sexual assault this vision of the kind of archetypal rape victim as a college student. And when in fact it does appear that going to college actually does, if it modulates your risk, it actually lessens your risk, right? That women who graduate from college statistically are somewhat less vulnerable to sexual assault than women who don't graduate from college.
Now, that's some degree a class marker, right? Because
yes.
Poor and working class women are far more likely to get raped than women of the upper class.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this point has been made by some women who work on, some feminist scholars who work on crime statistics in relationship to sexual assault and the like. So, you know, I found that their studies were really eye-opening. Also because like in this subject area, there's a lot of debate about like what constitutes assault, like how do we understand how people report in studies and report to schools and report to police. Like, you know, one of the things that really blew my mind was that college students statistically are less likely to report to the police than members of the general public. Right. And I think that might be because college students really invest in the idea that the university itself is going to look after them. They have this alternative to the criminal justice system, you know, which from my point of view, you know, no self-respecting radical feminist would ever turn to the criminal justice system as, the one space, right, wherein we can confront the problem of sexual assault and gendered forms of violence, right? When does it become okay to call for putting more people on jail or putting people on the sex offender registry for life? Like, why is this suddenly, this political position is almost completely unquestioned? And that's very much not okay, in my view, you know. So I find it, you know, like the idea, for example, and this is a kind of a hard position to take, you know, but, you know, the narratives around sexual assault tend to culminate in the call, you know, it's like the accused have no right to go to school, and then they get marked as people who can't go to school. So if you end up on the sex offender registry, for example, does this now mean you can't get a college education? There's so many other forms of violence and harm that people participate in that are not associated with that kind of a lifetime restriction on one's social mobility. You know, so this is this way in which like sex becomes this sort of exceptional state, right? Where the body itself becomes a state of exception in a sense.
You also write about something that people don't always talk about in these issues. Institutions like fraternities and football teams that are homosocial but homophobic.
Yes. There's part of it is coincidence, right? Insofar as when this news broke at Penn State that Joe Paterno had been fired in relationship to the huge scandal there regarding the abusive behavior of a member of the football team staff, you know, and that he'd been molesting underage boys and using his history in relationship to Penn State's football program as a way of grooming and accessing vulnerable boys. So Paterno was fired for that, and students revolted on the campus on the same day that students at UC Berkeley were protesting tuition. Those two stories actually got paired in commentary, you know, where you had one, you know, students on one side of the country taking a righteous stand against rising tuition, and then you had like the spoiled brats at Penn State. And I found myself really interested in the way in which the events at Penn State, where you know the students rioted, you know, that demonstrates the intensity, right, of the campus community's investment in a very specific form of patriarchal authority and power. And it's a deep emotional investment that's very edible, right? You know that. You know, Joe Paterno was called Jopa, right? Like he's explicitly worshipped as a father figure on the campus. Now, Paterno himself is not directly implicated in any of the abuse, of course, right, at Penn State. He was seen, however, as a figure of responsibility, right? And he was dismissed alongside a whole, you know, suite of university administrators who, in essence, really turned a blind eye to what was going on. When you look at the Free Report, which is this massive investigation of that incident, one of the things that becomes really clear, you know, is that these men are not able to think about the sexual politics of intimacy, right, in scenes of power and authority, right? Like they can't talk about sex except in a sexist and homophobic way, right, kind of locker room talk. They can't talk about the relationship of their physical intimacy with each other within a sporting context. People who can talk about that, those are folks, those are queer folks, right? Like those are the folks who kind of, in a way, see too much and know too much, right? Are inadmissible within those scenes, right? This is like, in essence, kind of basic awareness that grows out of lesbian and gay studies, for example. You know, it's almost like a given that we know how to speak about that as a foundation of a certain kind of literacy. You know, when you look at that world, you see people who are completely illiterate with regards to sex, gender, sexuality, like sex, gender, sexuality, race, and ethnicity as well, right? And so one of the things that really has struck me about recent demonstrations, for example, you know, student movement at Missouri, when you look at the people that were in power, that they're pushed out, you know, those men are completely illiterate when it comes to thinking about what an anti-racist campus might look like. Even a campus that's a white majority, right? It's sort of like they can't quite figure out what it would mean to be a white majority campus with an anti-racist commitment because they have no fluency. Like they don't have basic literacy. That's actually the better characterization, right, around these issues. And so they seize up with anxiety when confronted, you know, with real conflict and with the real difficulty of this level of social commitment. What happened at Penn State is, I think it's particularly shameful because there was a big Title IX complaint at Penn State that had been forwarded by a woman student who was playing on the women's basketball team who was kicked off the team because the coach then had an no lesbians policy explicitly. You know, this is a fairly recent case. And the entire athletics department staff was forced to undergo Title IX training. You know, and this is during the period in which they were also, like, members of that staff were dealing with some of these situations that were created by Jerry Sandusky's abuse of his power and authority, right? So, like, they're attending training sessions, you know, regarding sexual harassment and also reporting responsibilities. And I'm sure they just weren't listening or even, thinking that they had, that what was going on with regards to a woman basketball student had anything to do, you know, with their lives as men in the football program. Right, because these folks actually experience gender difference as a difference of species. Right, I mean they don't think of women as part of their world. They don't think of gay and lesbian people and transgender people as part of their community. And so the intelligence that comes from these marginalized spaces isn't something that they even see as intelligence.
And finally, do you think that this discourse around rape on campuses. Is it doing anything to develop the kind of sexual literacy you were talking about?
Yes and no. It sort of really depends from, you know, it varies from community to community, right? So, you know, in some places, the discourse on sexual assault and sexual vulnerability support, it kind of reinforces the sense of the female subject as always already vulnerable, as always already, in essence, a kind of a victim who, you know, she almost becomes intelligible as a female subject as a victim, right? It doesn't do enough to disentangle rape logics from discourse on gender difference, right? That's really challenging. You know, on the other hand, you know, and this has been true since Title IX was passed in 1972, the leading edge of the social transformation with regards to gender and schools at every level, right, has been led by students. Student activism around Title IX, like student initiatives to educate themselves with regards to what the law is and the ways in which one as an activist might use the law to make the campus a better space, right? The work that students are doing around this is having a very positive impact.
That was Jennifer Doyle, an art historian, literary critic, and sports writer whose book Campus Sex, Campus Security was recently published by Semiotext. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a sample of a very different notion of the campus from that covered by Jennifer Doyle. This from the Whiffen Poofs, one of those silly institutions that only the likes of Yale could produce, doing their signature tune, Bright College Years. Till next week, bye.
Bright college years with pleasure rife, the shortest, gladdest years of life. How swiftly are ye gliding by? Oh, why doth time so quickly fly? The seasons come, the seasons go, the earth is green or white with snow, but time and change shall not avail to break the friendships formed that year. In after years should troubles rise to cloud.